that our tax money is going towards what we want to see, things like new roads, updated metro systems, perhaps even better public services. We rarely think that our tax money is going to fund and help what we don't want to see, things like prisoners and jails. But the unfortunate reality is that a big portion of tax money goes towards a system of incarceration and supporting and maintaining the lives of prisoners. There are millions of people locked behind bars around the world, and while living conditions vary, at the end of the day, there's still a major drain upon society. So is there a solution to this problem? I'm Christy Yai, and you're watching The Cost of Everything, where today we're going to be examining how much goes into the cost of incarcerating and maintaining criminals behind bars. In the US, state governments have spent a combined $55 billion on state prisons in 2020 for over 1.2 million people who are locked behind bars. While spending per prisoner varies drastically between state to state, from $18,000 per prisoner in Mississippi a year all the way to $135,000 per prisoner in Wyoming, the average the state spends is $45,771 per prisoner. Now, one of the major costs of a prison's budget goes to the salaries and benefits for correctional officers. The average annual salary for an officer was $53,420 in 2021. But in high-wage states like California, New York, and Massachusetts, officers make double the salary of those in low-wage states like Mississippi, Louisiana, and Georgia. Another factor that determines prison spending is the operational cost of the prison facilities. These are higher in states with older prisons that require more upkeep, and in states where there is a relatively large prisoner population. Now, Alaska tops all of the states with the highest incarceration rate of 625 prisoners per 100,000 residents. Geographically, the South has a higher prisoner incarceration rate compared to the West or the Northeast of America at 424 prisoners per 100,000 residents. And in total, the Bureau of Justice estimates that the U.S. spends more than $80 billion each year to keep roughly 2.3 million people behind bars. And this includes all of the prisoners locked up between thousands of federal, state, local, juvenile correctional facilities and tribunal systems. And even with such a high budget, public prisons have become overcrowded as the number of prisoners continue to rise. So, like in most industries, the public sector turned to the private sector for help. Private detention centers are seen as a quick fix to the problem of overcrowded, understaffed public prisons. And today, privatized prisons make up over 10% of the corrections market, turning over $7.4 billion per year. Now, there's a range of private industries and public agencies who continue to profit from mass incarcerations. Private companies are frequently granted contracts to operate prison food and health services and even prison telecom and commissionary functions. This has spawned a multi-billion dollar private industry with things like phone calls, medical care, and commissionary costs offloaded to the families of prisoners. These private companies offer a correctional solution that prevents the government from having to sink in more capital into brick and mortar of new prisons and other long-term costs, such as pensions and salaries and healthcare for new prison staff. Private prisons not only provide state and federal government with a lower per diem cost, but they also provide a means for them to balance their budgets by buying off and refurbishing state-owned prisons. CCA now operates the fifth largest prison system in the U.S. with 51 owned and operated facilities. This allows CCA to maintain a 44% stake in the $7.4 billion private corrections market, who recorded billions of dollars in revenue. Studies agree that privatized prisons save money on the balance sheet between 19 to 28%. So why are prisons such a good business even though you're dealing with convicts and punishment? Well, to explain more, we'll bring in the best in this topic. We got Anthony Gangi, prison manager and author of Inmate Manipulation Decoded, and Connie Allien, prison educational consultant. So let's start with you, Anthony. First of all, in what country are prisons the most expensive?
I would have to say probably the United States, due to the fact that we may have a good amount of individuals incarcerated and then the level of care that we provide to meet their needs.
And Connie, in what country are prisons the least and the most humane?
The least and the most, that's a tough one. So I would say most humane, I think I may have seen New Zealand or like the Netherlands, I wanna say I've seen as most humane. And least, I might have to say like maybe India.
What do they do differently in New Zealand?
So what I've seen in those institutions is more of a creation of a community of corrections. So many of the facilities look like little apartments. There's just a different way that I think they engage, and I believe the population is able to kind of go out and work. So there's a level of preparedness for returning to society. I think in America, we do some of that, but there is a level of step down and more of a controlled environment for that to happen here. And then I feel like in some of the third world countries, there is more of a responsibility for the families to take care of the offenders. So there are times where like a family member has to go and make sure they have food and they have sort of their basic needs met. Whereas in America, like that's part of our care process.
And Anthony, you wanted to add a comment?
Just kind of in partnership. So obviously countries like New Zealand will be doing like integration models. So basically looking to rehabilitate the offender for reentry, which is basically what we obviously do here in the States. But I think that for me, the models that are probably the least humane are the ones that have least amount of supervision. Like I've seen some in Central America or South America that don't have direct supervision. They don't have any staff oversight. They basically do things from a distance, and they basically allow the inmates to fend for themselves, which to me, you wind up having facilities that are ran by the offender population as opposed to some level of staff oversight.
And now this question goes for both of you. Ideally, prisons are supposed to be used for rehabilitation and reform and not necessarily punishment. But is that really how it works in reality?
All right, so I've been involved in the system for 20 years. So through my experience, there is a level of accountability even in regards to reintegration. So technically, what we have to do is we have to look at the system not based on the extremes of what's shown to us on TV to pull some political perspective. We're supposed to look at actually how jails and prisons operate. Because what you see on the TV could be an extreme that's based on human failure and not what the design of the system is. So sadly, what winds up happening is that model winds up becoming the standard definition, and then they start making changes that are already being done, that's already been included, but somebody wants to be the hero and then base that extreme on this is how the system works. We do have especially in the States, we do have education. So we have things that help the offender while they're in their stay. And then we also have things that prepare them for reentry. So we have models, education, social services, mental health, religion, chaplaincy programs. I mean, drug treatment programs. But the other thing is also is that we could provide it. But you have to, you know, get them to want to take it. So there has to be some level of accountability first in order for them to admit that there is a concern. So if we do make a change, the change is natural. I'll give you an example. There's places where they have sex offender treatment, you know, and before we're able to address their treatment, they must admit that what they have done was wrong. So we know that the change is sincere and not just something that you're selling us. So once you get released, you would still continue to be a threat. So a lot of people may not be willing to take some programs because they feel if they take the program, it could admit that they're wrong. And right now they could be going through an appeal. So they don't want to say, well, I'm going to go ahead and take this program. But then if I take this program, I'm fighting saying I'm not guilty. So now if I do this program, people are going to think I'm guilty. Or some people will say, well, you know, if I do take this program, it's going to get me out sooner. Well, the problem is that incentive also doesn't work because you're not taking it for the right reasons. So it's a filtering process. It's making sure that not only do you have the programs to provide, but people are taking it for the right reasons and not for anything external, more from helping someone from the inside out. But in my experience, in my 20 years, I've seen the work from the civilian staff and those that look to help to rehabilitate and reentry back into society. And I know the effort behind it, but sometimes, not all the times, because a good percentage of inmates will put the effort, do the right thing and leave and never come back. But there are some where it's like just talking to a brick wall. And we could only do so much before we have to start saying, you know what? We're spending too much energy on this one when I got 20 others ready to turn over. So we have to start getting to the 20. But Connie's from the civilian side. I'm sure she'll have a lot of insight on that as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that, you know, when we think about incarceration in America, we know that there is definitely a very high rate of incarceration. And I think that sometimes people assume the worst, right? You know, it's the assumption that everyone's being mistreated or mishandled. And the system is based on the inmates getting services, and they do get their Eighth Amendment right, always respected, right? So they are entitled to be, if they are in custody, not at, in any way, shape, or form, receiving any cruel or unusual punishment. And so from a civilian perspective, that means if an inmate has a toothache, right, we don't let the individual sit with the toothache all day or all week, right? Like, are there services that we're always trying to provide? Of course, medical, mental health, dental. We provide them with meals. We provide them with programming. There are many instances where you have staff who are going above and beyond to ensure that the population has access to things that they need in order to successfully transition back into the community. I think that the good news stories are usually not the ones that make the front page. And so we end up basing our opinions on what we do see, right? And what we usually see are the negative things that are happening. And, you know, it's kind of like, how do we say, oh, you know, that was just, you know, a bad one, right? But a lot of instances, that is it, right? This is something that happens in this situation under these circumstances. And we can't use that broad stroke brush to say this is how everyone treats all offenders in these facilities when we, in fact, have people who are really passionate about the work they do.
Yeah, like I want to, if I can. So if you look at what's in the policy for the systems, you'll see that the system has a high level of expectation in regards to what must be met, especially related to the offenders' care and well-being. Now, having said that, do we have people that fail to meet those expectations? Yes. But is that how the system should be defined? No. Those people should be held accountable, because you are going to find people that don't do what's expected of them. And then people are quick to say, well, you know what? Because Ganji didn't do it that way, the whole criminal justice system is broken. There's no Ganji messed up. Ganji was not doing what's expected. So therefore, the system is still working, just Ganji's got to be held accountable. What we've done lately is have these extremes, use them to generally define the system, but then remove accountability from it. So Ganji is not accountable, because Ganji's just representing the system that expects that. And we would come around and say, no, Ganji is accountable, because there's nothing in the system that told them to deny the inmate of these services. Like, I love what Connie said. Have I ever seen an inmate sitting in pain? When you have a facility that's operating the way it should be operating under those expectations, no. Because I have seen us scrambling on the other side of that liability, making sure that we don't torture that inmate. We do give that inmate proper care. Now, having said that, that still requires strict oversight, because if word came out that we had an inmate sitting in pain, and he did everything to get called down to medical, and we just decided not to do it, people are going to lose jobs, at least by the standards that I've operated on. They're going to have a major excuse as to why that inmate was not brought to medical and why he was not treated as such.
Thank you so much, Anthony and Connie, but please stick around. Our experts will be joining us here after the break. And when we come back, we will analyze the cost of US and Europeans' drastic correctional practices. We'll have more after the break.
The NATO summit in Vilnius is upon us. The only certain outcome is that Ukraine will not be invited to join the alliance anytime soon. In the meantime, Ukraine is asked to sacrifice its young men on a promise that will probably never be kept. Washington likes it that way.
What?
Are you crazy?
Yes.
War took a lot. I lost most of my friends. Back there, I was broken. I wasn't able to save anyone. I did nothing in that day. I met Wilson 2013. God put Willie in my way and made me start talking to Willie.
Willie for Ami? Is the heaven. I'm happy that Rami find his Willy.
Wilson, يمكن درتي ما معي.
He become my new friend, the one who's not gonna die in war. Because he is, he will stay alive, he will stay next to me. If I'm not crazy enough, I'm not gonna make it.
The US and European correctional philosophies differ drastically. The prime justification for incarceration over probation or community service for Europeans is to enable prisoners to lead a productive, crime-free life upon release. The main objective of removing the offender is to maintain the community's safety by rehabilitating and effectively reintegrating and re-educating the inmates before releasing them. A report found that European countries direct more effort into social reintegration than punishment. And practices in Germany and the Netherlands allowed for inmates to prepare for release, ready to face the world as a productive citizen. During the time they're serving their sentences, they are granted privacy and are educated to use conflict resolution skills. This is very different from American ex-prisoners that continue to be punished after re-entry. European inmates are able to reclaim their societal freedom and rights. But in contrast, American ex-cons are confronted with losing the right to vote and difficulties obtaining employment, housing, and public assistance, all of which increase the likelihood of returning back to a life of crime. China also has a unique feature with re-education through labor, or a system of special administrative detentions. Sentences under re-education through labor were issued as a form of administrative punishment, rather than according to criminal law. Meanwhile, spending on prisons in England and Wales is higher than in any other European country except for Russia. In 2019, the total budget was £3.4 billion, which is considerably higher than neighboring countries like Germany at £3 billion and France at £2.5 billion. Now, the UK as a whole has the third largest prison population in Europe at 91,870, after only Russia at 519,000 and Turkey at 297,000. The UK also is pushing to introduce longer prison sentences and change release provisions to keep some inmates in prison for longer. Statistics show that the average prison sentence in England is currently the longest it has been for a decade, standing at 19 months. With every country having a specific correctional philosophy, would it be challenging to come up with a global rehabilitating criminal program other than a prison? For the answer on this and more, we welcome once again Anthony Gangi, prison manager and author of Inmate Manipulation Decoded, and Connie Alien, prison educational consultant. So now, what is the most common prison charge globally?
So yeah, usually most crimes underneath is gonna be some level of drug use. Not all of them, but there's a good portion where if you really get to the, dig deep, kind of the bottom of the iceberg, you're going to find that there could have been some influence with some drugs or alcohol maybe. So obviously a lot of our facilities are definitely going to have some type of NA, AA. We'll even go as far as having gamble anonymous or sex anonymous. So you're looking at behaviors that are compulsive by nature, where they're motivated more by an impulse than reasoning. But I would say for me, drug use could be one, but mind you, drug use is not always a victimless crime because it could escalate depend on their want for that drug. So I know some people think, well, they're only hurting themselves, and that's not always the case, because once that drug addiction becomes so overwhelming that that drug becomes their priority, they will sell their children to get that drug. It is what it is. So I would say the underneath tone would always be some level of drug use in which it could have led to whatever crime it could be. Yeah,
because I think that's where it sort of spins out, right? So it's the drug use or a drug related crime, and then there's robbery, there's weapons charges that usually come along with that. This oftentimes coupled with like an assault charge, and then as those things start to spiral, then you end up with homicides and such. So if I had to sort of just take an educated guess on that one, I would say typically some sort of drug possession, drug use is usually involved, and then it just begins to spiral from there.
And do you think prisoners are exploited for labor, or are they working for a reduced prison sentence or good behavior, which makes it an equitable trade?
All right, So prisons are very self-sustaining. Obviously, we all know that, right? So some states do pay the inmate population a certain amount. It's not what you're going to find on the streets. It's going to probably be very cheap labor. But then again, there's also costs that they're also paying for the inmate to reside there, don't forget. They may only get paid a certain amount, but they're also getting medical for free, programming for free, food for free, whatever living arrangements are. And by the way, another side note, a lot of these people that go through the jail system have never even had care for medical or never even been seen by mental health. A lot of the times when we're discovering a CERN is when they're going through the jail and it's been discovered by the workers who work behind the wall, like the mental health professionals or the medical. But I'm not going to say it's slave labor, because there's another thing that's being done here that some people overlook. They're learning trades in the process. I got food service workers who are coming out with ServSafe and, certificates. So when they get out, they can get right into, helping out in the food industry. I got maintenance workers that inmates are working maintenance, but in the process, they're learning how to be a mason, learning how to weld. And then when they get out, they have opportunities. They know how to drive a forklift. So I do think there's a balance, but in the process, while they're working, they're being educated by a supervisor who's like a trade instructor, who's going to wind up helping getting them certified. So when they get released, they could wind up getting some vocational trade. But again, prisons are self-sustaining, and in order to save some level of money from the taxpayer, there is some labor that we do rely on the inmate population for. But having said that, in return, they do take whatever they're being taught, and they could apply that gift out into the real world. I know a lot of inmate maintenance workers that first off want to be called out because it's something for them to do. Let's not forget that they want to get out of their cell. But then when they get out, it's like, dude, I'm the best plumber. And they get out and they get a job $40, $50 an hour right from the get-go because of their experience working in the prisons and jails. So, I want to see it both ways. But in my experience, I just find that it does become beneficial if they take advantage of the learning opportunity behind what is being tasked towards them, as opposed to just saying, well, I'm not doing that, I'm not a slave. Well, it's not that. It's you're part of a program. At the end of the day, you do this, you could become a Mason or whatever it is, and then you can go out and take that skill with you into the real world.
I think one of the things that, you know, people talk about in this context also is that, you know, the population has no control over what kind of job they do, right? And so there are limited assignments available, and there's some positions where you have to be qualified to do the work, right? And so we may have to pick certain people to do certain things because this is what is required. And you have some individuals who don't want to do what's required in order to hold that position or do that job. So it's, there's more, I think, detail in the employment process as it pertains to an inmate in prison. I think it's easier to say, oh, it's cheap labor and everyone's, you know, the prison system's benefiting. But no, here are all the options, and which they are limited. These are the options available to the population. We have to be able to pick and choose and give people opportunities to grow and to learn, especially those who will be transitioning back into the community soon, because those are the ones who need to be employable, right? They need to have some sort of skill that they've cultivated over that time and that they're going to give into, well, they're going to learn from and be able to take it with them when they go. So as much as, you know, there's a thought that they should be paid more money and all of that, there's also this restitution, essentially, that is being paid back for the crimes they committed and to the people they've offended.
Thank you so much, Anthony Gangi and Connie Allian, for your time today. While it's hard to think of prisoners as winners and losers, it seems like those incarcerated in Europe win out over those behind bars in America, as they're given a better chance at reintegrating into society after their sentence. Currently, there are various movements who are trying to follow Norway's example of prison reform. Norway has one of the lowest rates of formerly incarcerated population committing another crime within 2 years of release. Even after 5 years, it was still extremely low at only 25% of the population. Meanwhile, this rate is one of the highest in the world in the U.S., with almost 44% of criminals released returning to prison within their first year out. Researchers have attributed this high rate to a plethora of factors ranging from social stigmatization and inadequate skills necessary for employment. I'm Christy Yai. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you right back here next time on The Cost of Everything.